pals o' mine. Have any of you bought a fruit salad tree? I just saw this recently. It's up to 6 different fruits on a single tree, grafted together. You have to make sure the branches are all even when it's growing, so that's too much work for me. I don't know, it's kind of weird looking. I guess it would make a great conversation piece or unusual present for avid gardeners. My grandmother would get a kick out of it. As you know, I love to hike. I'm not in the advanced level, but as a hiker, I can certainly appreciate high altitude peak summits. Actually, I'm in awe of them. I can't even imagine, though, how tackling Everest would be on anyone's list. Have you seen the photos of ladders just dropped across insanely deep crevices? And most of those ladders are wood with tape around weak spots. But then the awe factor rises several notches for the Sherpas, without whom Everest summits could not be attempted, let alone accomplished. Periodically, the news will broadcast someone who has skied Everest or the oldest person has summited. But on April 30th, the world's focus was on the 16 Nepalese Sherpa guides who died in an avalanche at the Khumbu Icefall. The event also brought to global light what longtime climbers have known for years, that the Sherpas have financially suffered due to the corruption of Nepal's Ministry of Culture, Tourism, and Civil Aviation. Permits, promotions, etc., all run through the ministry. And even though it is touted that it aids its people, the Sherpas see none of it. This tragic event was the infamous straw that broke the camel's back. The Sherpas have had enough and have drawn up a petition of demands. They will not lead expeditions again until those needs are met. Climbers around the world are 100% behind them. To provide a better understanding of the life of a Sherpa and how we can support them, I spoke to veteran climber Kevin Van, who recently completed the last of the 7 summits and is a partner of Trek 8848, which leads trekking expeditions, including Everest Base Camp. Van has spent many hours with Sherpas, and he provided some insight into their lives, their challenges, and the respect they have garnered from climbers of all levels. So when was your first trek up Everest?
I can date my history with the Khumbu Valley back to 1985. I had an opportunity after hearing, when I was living and working, going to school in the Phoenix area, and I heard this presentation about trekking to Everest Base Camp, and it was just an inkling about wanting to just check it out, see the beautiful photos. But knowing that I actually had an opportunity, it was in the spring of 85, I joined a group from, like I said, mostly Phoenix, Colorado area, one of the most impressionable, beautiful places on earth. And obviously by returning several times since 85, to me it means it's the most sacred and special place on the planet. So I have a long history with the Khumbu Valley and the Sherpas.
Well, tell me about your first trek up summiting Everest. What was that like?
Well, that was several years later. The trek, interestingly, is, and this is, seems to be the pattern with a lot of people who go trekking and then they become a climber. So in 1985, I found out that I could probably do altitude, and just by trekking, because you're going to be going to an elevation of 19,200, which is appreciable. I felt really good, felt confident in just the trekking to a peak called Kalapatar, which is 19,200. And I thought, well, my body seems to be able to adapt at altitude. Maybe I'll try this climbing thing. And so it progressed to that, and I felt that, of course, you don't go just trekking one year and summiting the next year on Everest. You have to build up and basically have a climbing resume. So over the next several years, I would climb a 6,000-meter peak or then a 7,000-meter peak, like Aconcagua in South America, which is about 23,000 feet. And then finally an 8,000-meter peak in 2001 in Tibet called Chōyu. It would be the sixth highest mountain in the world. And then after climbing that and with the same team, I was invited to join them in 2003 to attempt Everest. And especially since the 1996 disaster, which everybody hears about, of course, chronicled by Krakauer in Into Thin Air, that expedition companies weren't so keenly interested in knowing what your climbing resume was. But after that tragedy, people really had to present a history about where they've been and how high they've been. Because before that, many people who could just climb, and the Sierra and the Colorado Rockies are very impressive mountains, but it's all about altitude, and altitude changes everything. So until you got to the point where you could go and get into some really thin air, you don't really know how your body's going to manage. So that's where the benefit, the result of the 96 tragedy was that the positive result was that it created an environment where there had to be some degree of accomplishment. It just wasn't a matter of having the ability to write a $60,000 check to go to the summit. Or that price could be as high as $100,000. Some of the premier outfitters who give you one-on-one Sherpa contact. It's basically an area that has come under a lot of scrutiny, and it goes back to when you see the numbers of people that are attempting it, what I'm seeing is that they have gone back on their promise to insist on a climbing resume. And now they're taking people with money again and who don't have the experience of going to 7,000-8,000 meters before Everest. Now it's gone back to, if you can write a check, come on.
And we talk about we're referring to the ministry?
Well, the Ministry of Aviation and Tourism, pocket, and it's not known exactly, but you can do some math, and it's estimated between $3 and $4 million a year, probably more toward the high side of that. These are monies that are gathered when they do the issuance of the climbing permits. And say, for example, a climbing permit is $75,000. That's typically divided amongst 7 or 8 people in a team. So each team member is responsible for ponying up $10,000 apiece. Well, that's an appreciable amount of money. If you're looking at that times 40 or however many camps are there at base camp, well, then it starts to be a multiplier effect. They say, okay, well, that's great. Well, where does that money go? Well, for the longest time, the Sherpas were saying, well, we're not seeing any of it. It's all staying in Kathmandu. It's going into the pockets of well-connected people. And the money is not being funneled back to the Khumbu or Mount Everest National Park. As is typical is the case of Nepal, it is still one of the most corrupt countries in the world. And the ministry, the people in power, it's just implied that there's a certain degree of bakshish tips of monies that they keep. And they'll pay some lip service to the Sherpas and the Nepalese Mountaineering Association that they're promoting their tourism, when it's basically, the Sherpas will tell you, they're not receiving any of that. And if you consider that they get about $400 compensation to a child of a Sherpa climber, and that's the only compensation they get, well, that's criminal. That Sherpa climber, and this is pretty well documented as far as what they can make between $5,000 to $8,000 in a Mount Everest spring climbing season. That involves about between 2 and 3 months of really hard work, dangerous work, as we have now seen documented. The average Nepalese citizen, worker, makes about $400 a year. So that's an appreciable difference. People say, well, how in the world would you risk your life for $5,000 or $8,000? You talk to the Sherpas, and it's the best gig out there for what they do. People such as myself would never have been able to climb with our own skill sets. The mountain is just way too dangerous, and especially now where there's so many people on it, you need a way in which to convey all these masses of humanity up there in a safe manner, because if you just go on a free-for-all, it would be absolutely treacherous with rock falls and ice slides. There'd be multiples of deaths if it wasn't for the Sherpas setting the line every year.
You've got to know some of these Sherpas pretty well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The way you really get to know the Sherpa is to be in the same camp when the wind is howling and you're eating the same food. I have a medical background, and my business partner, Rob Casterly, he's a doctor. So we are often the go-to persons for the Sherpa when they have something as minor as a cut, or they're having some pulmonary congestion. They use our expertise in that regard, and we both focus on high-altitude physiology. The reciprocity is that, obviously, we get the benefit of their skills, and that it's really a talent to place an ice screw on the side of a glacier that's 45 degrees and hoping that ice screw is going to hold for several hundred people who are going to be using that rope going up. So you're putting your life in their hands, and in some small way, just by doing something, as we think, is just routine, just by bandaging up a cut finger, you're building an incredible rapport with these folks. We've known them. I've climbed in the Himalaya since 2001, and I still have friends from those expeditions. As a matter of fact, since 2003, after summiting Everest with Dr. Casserly, he and I just absolutely loved our experience. We always felt like we would welcome the chance to go back to the Khumbu yearly, if need be. And how do we best accomplish that? Well, we both love the trek, love climb, have great Sherpa friends. So we created a trekking company. And when we did this, it was the intent of being a bit altruistic, perhaps, but we would employ the Sherpas who we climbed with in 2001, 2003. And they would be helping to be our guides, but they also had, at this point, established lodges in their villages. And that's typical of what the Sherpa will do. They will work really hard, concentrate their efforts to be a high-altitude Sherpa for between 5 and 10 years. That money would go to building or buying a lodge. And then when we take our trekkers up through the Khumbu Valley, we stay at the lodges of the Sherpa who we were climbing with. So this is a bit of our way of paying back.
Providing them a private income separate from the
private
government.
Income. We eat in their lodges. We stay in their lodges. We get special treatment, but I think our clients believe that be the case as well. So this is a way of giving back. We also have Sherpas who do our logistics in the Khumbu and also down in Kathmandu. So this probably, we're employing 3 Sherpas in each trip, and the Sherpas know some of the people who would be as porters. So we're employing them, proudly paying double the wage of what an average porter gets for a trek in the Khumbu. So again, Rob and I have the benefit of having a daytime job. As we realize that this is not going to be our primary source of income, but it pays for the bills, if we're giving back, and we're not just writing a check, we're actually employing several people and paying them a very healthy wage.
Paying them what they earn.
Well, they certainly earn more than that. All it takes is just a chance to put on a strap across your forehead and lift the baskets that these porters are having to lift and to carry up mountains with diminishing oxygen. And then when you realize that you're in weight that is at least half of your body weight, although again being altruistic, and we believe it's very, very important, our porters do not carry more than 40 pounds. We want to insist on fair treatment, and many other trekking companies, we are probably going to be responsible for maybe inflating prices, and we don't want to be responsible for that, but they need a better wage than what they're getting. And then again, it goes back to the Sherpa. You think, well, that's great. You know, they're making between $5,000 and $8,000 for a season, and that, again, is so much money compared to what the average Nepalese makes.
Now, what is the length of a season?
There's all types of preparation that goes into a Mount Everest climbing. Typically, the mountain will open, say, on March 15th. So the government will open it up, which means that teams can start coming in, trickling in, and start preparing tents for base camp. Now, that sounds like how big of a deal is that? Well, it's a glacier with a rock quarry on top of it. You can imagine that. And boulders as big as houses sometimes. Certainly boulders the size of a kitchen table. It's a glacier. It's moving. This is at the base of the Khumbu Icefall. So this glacier is moving. Some people say up to a meter a day. And as you can imagine, cracks develop. Where you had a tent established on the 1st of April may not be the same location that it ends up at the latter part of May, because it's moving and the weather is warmer.
That quickly.
It does. And I've actually experienced where I had a crack underneath my tent after sleeping one night. So it moves. I think disparity wages is what has a lot of people concerned. When they hear about Westerners going to Everest, paying upwards of $100,000 for the privilege of climbing it, and then they realize that, well, the Sherpa's only getting, you know, $5,000 to $8,000. Now, these are the high altitude Sherpas. These are the best paid. And then you wonder, well, that's not fair. Well, the thing is, the Ministry of Tourism and Aviation, they're keeping a huge pocket. I mean, they're pocketing a lot of this money. Again, if they were to refunnel it back into the Khumbu, it'd be different. We wouldn't be having these conversations. But the Sherpa know, they're smart, they're very smart. Many of them speak 4 or 5 languages. If a French team comes into town, they have to adapt to the French. Likewise from the Italians. I mean, it's just amazing. They're smart, they're resourceful, and they know technology. They're not just backs. They're strong backs, they're the strongest people, you know, pound for pound than any people as I know in the world. But they're very, very smart. Westerners talk to them. They say, hey, well, you know, I paid this much money. It's just, you know, discomforting to know that you get this little bit. And what's even more disconcerting is that you have this insurance policy that pays you nothing, it's in essence, for dying. Of course, the reason why they're doing this is to better the lives of their children, like any person on the earth.
Most parents.
They want to have a better outcome for their children. So they're doing this, they're working, and instead of keeping their kids up in the Khumbu, they're making enough money to send their kids to schools in Kathmandu. Again, that becomes a cultural issue. It's another story in and of itself, but they want so badly for their child to have a business degree and have office job, as opposed to being on the side of a mountain in a hurricane force gale and dying, quite possibly. They don't want their child to follow them, for the most part, in their footsteps.
So in addition to being a pack mule, basically, what else are they doing specifically details as you're following them up? Are they ahead of you?
They're ahead of us. The typical, and you may know this, but I'll, for your listeners, there are two styles of expeditions. One is the small and fast, and the other is the expedition style. What has gained ground lately are the super climbers who are able to have pack lightly, go in for the intent of having only 2 days worth of ration, hoping the weather is perfect, and then just blast it up the mountain. That's the rarity. Those are the super climbers, the elite. Then there are the climbers such as myself who have to go the expedition style. And that requires ferrying loads further up the mountain. So again, what the typical season on Everest would be, everybody's getting to base camp. Again, the Sherpa's already got the tents lined up, set, ready to go. The climbers come into base camp, boom. The comforts of home already. It's a tent, but it's comfortable. So the tent is prepared. And then there's some acclimatization, and you have to work through some gear. Then you have what's called a puja. Puja is a ceremony that every climber, Westerner and Sherpa, attends. And it's by a lama who comes to the base camp. And then several of these pujas go on at one time. And so it's a 3-4 hour ceremony. And there's a lot, and you're blessing your crampons, and you're blessing your ice axe, all these things. And then the Sherpa get reassurances from the Lama that it's an auspicious day to climb, for example. So, in essence, they have to get the go-ahead, the spiritual awareness that this is the approach, this is the day you should go for the summit. And they'll actually offer that. And they're basically giving him good luck. Once the Sherpa has that, and they know that they have the green light from the Lama, then they can proceed and do what they do best, and that's lead up the mountain. Several of the ones who are leading the way are, every morning, are the ice doctors, or the ice fall doctors, as they nickname them. These are the, really, about 4 to 6 really elite Sherpas whose job is every morning, something like 4 a.m, they head out and they go up their ice fall and they rearrange the ladders. Again, remember, this is a glacier that's constantly moving. An ice pack could fall on a ladder and just snap it. So they'll have to replace it or rig it some other way. The route changes. They have to do that. And again, in 2003, as an example, I counted over 40 ladders that I had to climb or traverse cracks with. Now, throughout my up and down, you know, my routes in ferrying equipment, food, oxygen tanks, I had to negotiate several different routes up the Khumbu Icefall. So the ice doctors are the ones who are preparing it. They're up, they lead the way, they set the rope. And then as the rope is set, in essence, every foot from that point, from base camp, essentially to the summit, is set. There's a rope. The typical exception would be between Camp 2 and Camp 3. You're not online all the time, but you're going across a glacier. So, again, what they're doing, the Sherpas are doing, they're out front, they're negotiating a route, and they're the ones who are taking the risk, especially up front, establishing a route. As was the case on April the 18th, they were up front, and it's sad enough that any person lost their lives, but the 16 who lost were some of the best climbers in the world. Names you'll never hear of because they don't have the Western sponsorship, the great photo ops. But these are the best of the best. And to know that they died, and then you hear about what they're compensated and what their families are compensated for their death, it's like that's criminal. Then the news is starting to open up about, well, why isn't there more insurance? Well, if the Nepalese Ministry of Tourism and Aviation were to invest in a life insurance policy that would properly compensate, then maybe the feelings wouldn't be so tense as they were. It's something that has been brewing. It's been just simmering for a long, long time. You know, their wages hadn't really gone up that much, although it's been more expensive the past few years to go trekking because inflation in Nepal and all over the world has taken its toll. But their wages for the high-altitude Sherpas haven't really appreciated that much. So high risk, sure. High rewards, relative. But if they do happen to succumb to an accident, how in the world are you, do you expect for $400 that child is going to make it out of from childhood to adulthood, and there's no other income coming in? So that child has to now become dependent on handouts, or further deteriorates their status in the community. They, being a high altitude Sherpa, is very much looked upon as a status symbol.
Revered.
Revered, absolutely. And there are several Sherpas I'm just like in awe of when I go to meetings and I happen to be in a council and we're talking about routes and preparations. And then you hear these Sherpas who are always, always humble. I remember back in 2003, I had a chance to meet Apa Sherpa. And in 2003, he had summited 16 times.
Wow.
Which is just mind-boggling. And so you're just in awe of these people because of what they can do and what they have done. I was in Antarctica in December just of last year, and there's a Sherpa named Lhakpa Sherpa. In 2003, he set the world record for the ascent and turn to base camp of any Sherpa, you know, any person in the world. It's just in hours, something like 16 hours. And it's just like, wait a second, that took me 4 days to do. So again, it just tells you the superior physiology and the mindset, and these superhumans deserve better compensation.
And it's also tough on closure for the families if they do lose their lives, because you can't always capture the bodies.
As a matter of fact, 3 of them are still buried. So 13 bodies were retrieved.
Is that because they were close? Because sometimes some bodies are left up there, is that?
No, they want to get their bodies down because it's very important for closure. They typically will go down to Kathmandu and involve in a cremation ceremony so they can have proper grieving. But the 3 bodies that are still in the ice fall, my understanding is that it just, number one, they can't find them. Number two, it's very dangerous and the ice is very labile still. You could be there for hours and hours digging, but you're always looking over your shoulder is that big ice cliff on the left buttress, that which is where the area which caused this avalanche. And it seems to be an area that causes a lot of avalanches every year. But you just never know. If that gives way, there's another avalanche and more people will be dying in the process of retrieving a body. So there is the dilemma. The Sherpas want the bodies. The Westerners really, really were trying to get the bodies out. But when they can't find them and they're caked in a cement soup that becomes the snow and ice after an avalanche like that, it's like concrete. It's really difficult to break into it, to get them out. And again, it's just a matter of finding them. Now, the glacier moves. Who knows when the bodies will perhaps be extracted or will somehow just will push out. And that's what happens. They found an Iceman in the Swiss Alps. Apparently, he had been in there for 5,000 years. Well, they presumed that he fell in a glacier, and the glacier pushed him out many millennia later. But it could be that they never find him, quite honestly.
In the past, because of the danger, the high risk of retrieval, is it true that there are bodies in certain areas that just, not by choice, but had to be left?
Sure, and whenever you're with a proper expedition team, they're going to ask you, there's a form called a disposition of body. And it's a one-page form, and you have the option of asking that they make every effort to retrieve your body and bring it home to your home country, or to simply leave the body on the mountain. For example, if you succumb to your climbing and you have the option of having people risk their lives, bring your body down, or would you be okay with them simply pushing your body into a crevasse and forever being entombed on Everest? You have that option. And they want to know ahead of time. It's funeral planning. And so I gladly wrote, push me off in a crevasse. And it's not being machismo. It's being practical. I don't want other people to be injured and die just to get my dead body down. More important in other cultures, personally speaking, I would be very content to have been buried on Everest. But again, it's not all about me. It's about, you know, other people's families and how they react. However, I'm the one who had to sign it, and that's what I did. It's sort of understood, everybody who's climbing should have that discussion. And actually, it should be a document.
Makes sense to me.
Yeah.
Now, there have been safety issues on this particular area for a while now, right? That haven't been addressed?
The popcorn field, as they call it. It's the most difficult part. Well, there's no easy part of the Khumbu icefall. As you get really close to where a base camp is, it kind of flattens out a bit. Still has its pools of water, which can cause issues as well. But it's the area where the Western Kum, CWM, which means like a saddle, and it's where that glacier, it's all Khumbu icefall, starts pushing itself over the ledge and now begins a very lengthy downhill move. And when that happens, that lip, that leveraged area, cracks. It's very unstable. And that's the area when the avalanche above them occurred. So they're in a very susceptible area. They're kind of in a wedge between the western saddle, you know, the western shoulder, the buttress of the Everest. And then you got Nuptse to the right. So both those mountains can funnel avalanches all the time. But then you're in the middle of a giant sérac fill where these, again, the glacier's moving, it's cracking, and you have a 10-story slab of ice hanging over you, and you're having to negotiate your route around that. And as you're going under this big sérac of ice, you know, you're just like, please just don't fall at this point.
Yeah.
It's luck. It's a gamble. Every time you go through the ice fall. I went through it on my 2003 expedition. I had to negotiate the ice fall 8 times. These Sherpas go through it maybe up to 20 times, ferrying items up and down the up the mountain. And they're paid by the number of trips they make. Bring one trip up, bring 30 kilograms, which is an outrageous amount of weight, but they're being paid by that. So they can act, depending upon how many routes they negotiate and how much weight, some of them can make 10,000. Plus, you would hope that there would be an appreciable, say, a gratuity by each individual climber at the end of it. That's not always a given.
I wondered about that.
Yeah. You know, these people have done a lot of, to get you up the mountain, and to hear of these very embarrassing amounts of money that are not paid to the Sherpas is, you know, it hurts just to hear that.
It's embarrassment for your fellow human beings.
Well, yeah, it is. And again, the Sherpas have been a little bit more forthcoming about that. You know, usually they would just like keep it quiet and just not say anything. But my sources, Rob Casserly, his wife, Marie Christelle, she's a very noted climber in her own right. So they were there with the intent of both of them climbing. Now, this would be Rob's 9th summit, and he wanted to bring his wife along with him. It would have been an absolutely amazing thing to see that. Rob also had a paying client, and he was also helping with Henry Todd's team. Now, Henry's a well-known expedition leader based out of Scotland, but be like the lead guide for the team. Robin, in his own, he's in the same status as the Sherpa. He has the physiology, very safe, very confident. And when I spoke with him recently about what happened, you know, there's a lot of different opinions. And one of the worst ways of getting a factual account of a mountain climbing accident is you have to be there by somebody who's done it. There is so much mis and disinformation that has come out of what has happened the past 2 weeks. So it's kind of sad, but you have to know that even, for example, John Krakauer's book, Into Thin Air, many, many people will dispute whole sections of what he said. I wasn't there in 96. Krakauer was, but he was on a team. And if you're on an A team, there are several other teams that are experiencing things that you really don't know about, and you're hearing about it firsthand. So if anything, we need to wait, let the information
filter down.
I think Krakauer was in such a hurry by his publishers to get a story out that he just kind of ran over a few facts.
For example?
Well, his impression about what happened is in conflict with Anatoly Bukharin, who arguably was the greatest climber in 1996 in the world. And from what the accounts enlisted in Krakauer's book were incomplete, well, were dissociated from what Bukharin said had happened. And I know people who had been there, and they said they believed in Bukharin and what he attempted to do. And I can't recall the details. It's been many, many years since I've read the book. But it's, in essence, defeated him, became a broken man, and it really just impacted his ego. And he was almost changed in that he felt he had something to prove, and he was climbing ridiculous routes after that just to prove to the world that he was capable of it. Anyway, it's one person's opinion. It's actually shared by many people who climbed and who were there in 1996. I know several people who were there. Mr. Krakauer's account is his opinion, and he's certainly entitled to it. But just keep in mind, whenever you read any article about what comes out of mountain climbing issues and incidences, they are notoriously noted for not having the full story.
Maybe the publisher has a hand in that to try to make it.
I don't doubt that. But it was definitely a rush job. If he were to go back and say, let's re-examine this story 20 years afterward, all right, let him have a chance to go back and interview the people who criticized and criticized people who criticized him as well. And let's have a historical account of what really happened, not having one person's opinion.
One camera angle. A lot of people were there.
It's a one camera angle, that's for sure. Yeah.
So your partner was there that day when this April 18th occurred?
Yes, and it was The ice doctors, the Sherpas, I had already left a couple hours ahead of time before the sun was even rising. Because that's what you need to do. You need to get out. You need to get in the Khumbu icefall and try to negotiate and get over the top before it. I mean, when I say the sun, I mean directly on it. It's amazing what reflective heat will do. It's, think you're freezing when you leave base camp, and you are. It's below freezing. When you get into a reflective zone, like in a glacier, the amount of sun bouncing off is so intense. You can certainly get a sunburn, that's well noted, but the temperature rises. And of course, as the temperature rises and you got a little bit of the ice begins to play a bit, ice is again moving, that is a really dangerous time for it to happen. Well, they felt pretty confident around 7 o'clock in the morning, but again, the light was starting to hit on the west buttress, a big ice field gave way. Of course, when it comes down, roaring down the mountain, it just becomes pulverized energy, and then whenever it hits something, it's just going to pretty awful. So these guys were right in the direction of it. Some of them were able to hide behind a giant block of ice and miss the majority of the avalanche, but again, 16 did not. We would have expected something like this, maybe like at between 11 and 3 in the afternoon, but the fact that it hit at 7 o'clock in the morning is, well, it's a crapshoot. They would have figured that they'd been well past the area of concern, and that if they had kept on going, they probably would have been on top of the ice fall by late morning.
Nature doesn't follow rules.
It doesn't. Rob was there. He heard it. And immediately they knew something was wrong. Of course, the radios from base camp to the Sherpas, who were injured but still alive. You know, all the base camps were just exploding with information like, what happened? You know, Sherpas down, Sherpas down. And they immediately tried to gather up a group of people to go up there and see what's happening. First report is that they knew that three were dead immediately. Went pretty close to immediate. And so everybody else was either missing or they just couldn't find what their status was. So Rob and several other elite climbers, they were probably just now getting up, almost getting ready for breakfast at this point, were now turning into a search and rescue. But still, they were at least 2 hours away. From a telescope, you could see what the Sherpas who were trying to extract their friends and their family members, but could only see that via a telescope. So that's 2 miles or 2 hours away. Now, obviously, there's a bit of urgency, but they're in there, they're trying to help out. But again, everything is still unstable. Once you have an avalanche, it doesn't mean it's all over. I mean, it could be a very unstable environment all around there. And again, a lot of the route had been knocked out by the avalanche, so they're negotiating more ladders. And so they decided that it was best to call in a chopper. So these very brave chopper pilots were willing to fly up to the area of the accident scene. You've seen the pictures, I'm sure, where they have a rope, have a basket, and they'll load the body on the basket and try to get the basket down to at least base camp, and then possibly further down the mountain, preferably to Kathmandu. But that's a whole nother trip. You're looking at least an hour. That was the best way to extract the bodies. But when they found out that all these people had died, it was like, now it's just a matter of returning the people who, the walking wounded, if you will, who were able to actually walk out of there. And very few did. So that's another thing that was so just pulverizing for morale, is that so many people died at one spot at one time. And very few were able to survive. Dawa, who's a Sherpa that we knew, he was injured, and they were able to fly him to Kathmandu. And I saw a picture of him in the hospital bed. So do I know anybody personally? Yes, but I didn't know anybody personally who actually perished. So Rob was there. He's a doctor, and he was able to assist as much as possible. But at this point, it's just a matter of they have to get down. There is an emergency medical tent at base camp, and they can do minor things. They're not going to be doing x-rays and blood transfusions and fixing broken femurs and things like that. It's just a matter of stabilizing them and getting them down to a proper hospital.
Do you think it's climate change or it's just Mother Nature doing what she's always been?
Well, yeah, I guess you could argue both. I am fully of the opinion that climate is changing, and people think that, well, climate change is going to impact places like the Seychelles and Miami Beach more rapidly or more importantly than any place in the world. It's been argued that the most impacted area in the world will be the Himalaya, and there's unstable glaciers, as we saw on April 18th, that are cracking and fracturing much too quickly. The melt-off can be so intense that there's flooding where there shouldn't be flooding. They depend on a certain flow in the summer months to do their fields for irrigation for agriculture, I should say. And they can't depend on it. They also have been trying to use more hydroelectric power, little tiny hydroelectric plants up there in the Khumbu that are producing energy, electricity. Instead of using yak dung to burn for your stove, you can, or you have light with electricity. So that's an area where we were trying to convert the use of wood and yak dung for energy and use instead relatively clean hydroelectric. Well, they're not getting a constant supply of that now. So their efforts to go electric have been hampered. Do you see glacial retreat? Absolutely. You see entire sections of mountains that have been carved off by rapid thaw and expansion. It's there. There's no question about it. I had an experience on Denali in 2007 with Rob. We were able to successfully climb the mountain, but on the way down, it was one of the most dangerous parts of climbing in my entire life. The glacier, which is supposed to be stable throughout the month of June, July, and August, started cracking open here in the latter part of June. So we're in a situation where we're having to negotiate crevasses, a giant crevasse field. It should not have taken us that long to get down the mountain, but it added several hours, and more importantly, the element of concern, because nothing changes your perspective like falling through an ice crack. And when I fell through twice,
holy crap,
you get your attention. Fortunately, I had Rob and some other teammates from Colorado were successful in pulling me out. It wasn't a big drop, but it's enough that, again, it can change your direction in life. That's for sure. So, yeah, that wasn't supposed to open up. And here it is. This whole ice field is wrought with crevasses. So, yes, absolutely, there is climate change.
So do you think that will affect future?
It does. Climbs? It has. The climbing season, it historically has been, well, say, for example, May 10 through May 29. That is when most people summit Everest. Well, people are arriving to base camp later. So instead of getting there end of March, first of April, they're arriving like the second week in April or so. And it's a shorter season. They better be ready to go. And will typically happen, and historically, I can't give you the exact number on the day by average, but somewhere like, say, May 17 to 22nd, somewhere in that, it's been where the majority of people summit. Now it's so unpredictable. It can go fully into June, which is a no-no. It used to be June 1st, boom, the mountain is closed. No more climbing. Get your bodies and your equipment off the mountain, because the Ministry of Tourism and Aviation, who's in charge of permits, says, not down by then, we're shutting you down. Now that season is unpredictable. The same thing in the fall. October is the second season, but not many people want to do that because it's just so unstable. Now you're losing the October climbing season for Everest. It's all on May. Now it's compacted. More people want to go. And if you happen to see, there's one picture that's very reminiscent of what's happening. In Everest 2012, there was a string of people that were climbing between Camp 3 and Camp 4. They were crossing this area, which is part of the Lhotse face. And it's like, my God, all it would take was an avalanche. There were at least 200 people online crossing this area. And if an avalanche came from above, it would wipe. It would have been at least, I guess, 50 fatalities. And it's just mind-boggling. So things are unstable. The seasons are unpredictable. And you want to go on vacation, or say if you're trekking, with the intention of, I'm going to arrive on this day and I'll return back to the States on that day. And for years, we could absolutely defend that. So yeah, you'll make it back, no question. Well, there have been cases in the past, about 2 years ago, where a huge fog that wasn't supposed to be there that time of year, this was in November, just socked in parts of the Khumbu Valley around Everest, and no planes could come land or take off. So people were stuck there for a few days. They all had their return flights on their international destination. It created an international incident because people had expected to be back on this day and they couldn't get out because of weather. So weather is changing. So it's one of the most delicate areas of the world. And again, climate change will affect the Himalaya more acutely than any place on Earth.
I've noticed just seasons here, in California. They get later and later and later and shorter. I realize all the snowstorms back east can't relate to this, but there's a reason that California is experiencing a drought. There's extreme changes in our weather. And you can keep your head in the sand for as long as you want. But yeah, this is, I think, a glaring example of what is actually factually occurring on this planet.
No, the economic impact of what's happened in agriculture in California is just devastating. I used to live in Fresno. feel for the all the farms that are fallow. They can't get water. They can't have agriculture. Not only is that the fact that you can't put out plants, then all those people who are expecting jobs to harvest aren't on the payrolls anymore. Now they're on welfare. There is like 40%, some sections of West Fresno County, like 40% unemployment. And that's drought related. Of course, that everybody just says, well, we're paying more money for prices of produce. Of course we are, because we're not making as much produce. The lifestyle of people who live in the Himalaya.
Well, that's what I was thinking. If they're used to a certain amount of number of tourists coming in to buy some of their locally handcrafted goods, and just like in Tahoe, you know, if it doesn't snow, they don't have the skiers, and the
right.
stores aren't doing as well. Is there something that maybe my listeners can assist? And I'll be providing a link after this interview where people can financially donate. But are there specific items that you witnessed that they could use?
They are very humble. You will not see a Sherpa on the trail with their hand out. They're too proud for that. But they do need things. You know, they need better health care, more access to health care, and anything with regards to school supplies is very much appreciated and needed. It's just, again, getting things up there is a problem. And of course, the easiest way to do that would be to donate monies to these charities who can actually, like say, buy the pencils and papers and books in Kathmandu and then have them flown up to the Khumbu Valley.
You don't think it would be more cost effective where we can buy them cheaper here in the States and then for the transportation to get to the actual villages?
Yeah, I mean, if you have, for example, if you have people who are, and we do this for our trekkers, and we have like an orphanage in Kathmandu, we will say, bring some items for this orphanage, but also bring some items, if you have room in your backpacks, to donate even crayons and coloring books. Not candy. Please, not candy. But supplies that they could use. If you happen to have extra rolls of gauze, a lot of my clients are from the healthcare, and they have access to talking to suppliers, and they can maybe get some certain supplies that they can use. Again, we have to be a little concerned about what we bring into the country, because again, it's inspected, and if you have pencils and paper and book supplies, it's not a big deal. You start bringing in drugs, antibiotics, the tourist police, the people in the airports get a little bit wary about that. If people are going and they have space, we highly recommend and appreciate them spending a little bit of their time and space in bringing supplies. And then they can hand those out personally to the different schools in the Khumbu. But the most efficaciously speaking, it's obviously better and easier to transport funds over to Kathmandu and let them buy exactly what they need and then bring it up to the Khumbu. People are so generous in this state and they want to give so much. But again, you're talking about what does it cost to bulky container full of supplies, and then you have to look at the fuel it takes to get it over to Asia and things like that. Certainly it's better than nothing.
Maybe a nice balance, sending some from this country where we can buy it at a better economic price, but also maybe buy some of the supplies from the actual country where it will be used to support the local economy as well. That'd be a nice balance, I think.
And that's one of our focus. We don't give charity, just for charity's sake. If you employ the Sherpa, they know how best to allocate their funds. Give them a job, pay them a respectable wage, and then they're happy. They know they're getting a good income, but when they feel like they've been abused, and certainly it's more about their own people. It's the Sherpa. Again, there's so many different indigenous groups within Nepal, but you have in the central government of Kathmandu, which is always in flux. One year it's communist, next year it could be, for 350 years or so, it was a kingdom, you know, the world's only Hindu kingdom. The times are changing, people have had a Maoist uprising for a decade, and they finally were putting pressure on Kathmandu to the point where they had to open up for elections. And at that point, the people were so ready for a change, they elected a communist government, a very, as predicted, inefficient and corrupt government. So people are reluctant to give money to the government of Kathmandu or Nepal, understandably. We funnel our efforts to the Khumbu specifically. There are many places in Nepal that need help. We, Rob and I, have chosen to focus our efforts on the place we love and the people who took care of us, and this is our way of giving back.
Surrogate families.
They are. You know, we consider the little village of Pangboche, which is one of the most picturesque spots on Earth to be our home away from home. We're staying with Gurman. He's my Sherpa friend who I have a picture of me on the summit with him. His family, they opened up a lodge. They've expanded it twice. And we're responsible for bringing tourism. Not just our group. We tell other friends who have trekking companies, hey, if you're up in Pangboche, stay with Gurman. He's busy, he's happy, and he's making money for his family. He did put his life at risk for a few years as a high-altitude Sherpa. But again, being focused, he saved, he invested in a lodge. He's a businessman now who is fully capable of putting the crampons back on and heading back up the mountain. And he would love to do that. Sometimes the wife says, you're done climbing. There's so many amazing Sherpas. The two people I always tell people that I've met over the years in traveling, and I've been very lucky to have gone to different countries, were the Pashtuns in Afghanistan when I was in a refugee camp there back in 87. And then the Sherpas. Things are changing. They're very loyal to a fault. One of their marks was being very humble. But now they've been emboldened. And this is how things are going to change. It unfortunately took this disaster to get the world's attention, to realize how much their own people, their government, has been ripping them off and not supporting them. And they've given a list of demands, what they think would be appropriate, better rescue efforts as a trust fund for their kids, let alone an insurance policy, which would certainly be a multiple of $400 a year. That's ridiculous. No, $400 for a one-time lifetime policy for a child of a Sherpa climber. That gives them 1 year of an ability to save money, perhaps, and maybe invest in something else if, again, the mother takes that money and pools it, for example. But there's no guarantee, and it's a tough life. And the Westerners all go back down the valley and back to Kathmandu, and the Sherpas have their valley all back by themselves. It's back to where, you know, no one comes up there. Very rarely you see tourists. They're having to go through intense weather just to survive. And as a matter of fact, now it's so severe and unpredictable that many of the villages closer to Everest, those north of Pangboche, many of those just shut down. There are places that are buried in snow up to the roof line. So there's not going to be tourism. So they have to make their money all in a very finite amount of time.
To cover for the year.
And then, of course, they want to do what's best for their children. That, again, I mentioned about sending them to school in Kathmandu. That's expensive. The Sherpa really need more than what they're getting. And they certainly deserve more respect from their own government. They have the respect of the Westerners. We are totally respecting their skill sets and their loyalty. And we're just totally in awe of their capability. But their own government has got to step up. And that's one bit of attention I think we need to
get behind.
And you mentioned about what to do as far as, I think I even saw something on the Discovery Channel last night about the Everest Avalanche Fund. I'm not sure if that's the actual name of it, .org or something. There are funds out there. Of course, each person needs to be careful.
Research them.
Yeah, research them, because I'm sure there would be other pop-ups that are just trying to take advantage of it. But funds that would give the money directly to the families of the Sherpas who died.
The nonprofit Alex Lowe Charitable Foundation has been working with Sherpa climbers in the Khumbu since 2003, so you can be assured that your donation will go directly to those in need. That's Alex Lowe, AlexLowe.org. In my ongoing celebration of the 150th anniversary of the National Park System, this week I'm heading over to Pennsylvania, to the Allegheny Portage Railroad National Historic Site, which covers 1,249 acres. The Allegheny Portage Railroad was 36 miles in length and the first railroad constructed through the Allegheny Mountains. It connected the Eastern and Western Canal Divisions, thus allowing continuous barge traffic, and it included the first railroad tunnel, the 900-foot Staple Bend Tunnel in the United States. The railroad was in operation for 20 years, 1834 to 54. Accidents were common on the Allegheny Portage Railroad. The engine house at Incline Plain No. 6 blew up, killing four people. In 1843, cars of bacon and whiskey left overnight in the tunnel caught fire from a locomotive spark, and the whiskey exploded. The Allegheny Portage was part of the Underground Railroad, the vast network of people who helped fugitive slaves escape to the North and Canada. The park is collecting stories of the specific tie between the two, so if someone in your family has ties, they would love to hear from you. The Allegheny Portage Railroad was rendered obsolete when the private company Pennsylvania Railroad constructed a locomotive railroad over the Alleghenies. Today, you can still see the system of inclined planes that made the rail construction possible. In addition to walking tours, there are also biking tours, which is cool. No train rides, though. Remember, trains stopped running there over 150 years ago. Happy Mother's Day to all the moms out there. Do you have a young daughter? Here's a great bonding opportunity. The philanthropic organization National Charity League fosters mother-daughter relationships through community service, leadership development, and cultural experiences. Its vision is to develop strong women leaders. Pretty cool. NationalCharityLeague.org. So here's another fun hashtag to follow on Twitter: fairy tale songs. For example, built a brick house, hit me baby once upon a time, get piggy with it, I've got you under my Rumpelstiltskin, it's a snow white wedding, the boy who cried werewolves of London, this slipper is made for dropping. Bet you could come up with a few. Do something different. Your next decision, rock, paper, scissors.